we ask someone to hold their peace, we really mean be quiet. Peace of mind is generally used when discussing a deodorant or a form of tax-deductible annuity. To say, may he rest in peace, means, of course, they're dead. So peace has a lot of meanings in a lot of different situations. I'm really sorry I missed the Bible study, and they talked about the Greek word peace. And we know the Hebrew word shalom being sort of a sense of wholeness and God's intention for life. And I think that's mostly what we as Christians think of when we think of peace. So we'll definitely talk about it in those terms. I'd like to maybe start, though, in I'm elementary school teacher by profession right now, just doing it part-time, but one of the things we do is called webbing, and it's basically brainstorming. You take a word like peace and put that at the center, and then just write down what comes to mind and web it off and see what you come up with. Would you help me do that? And what does come to your mind when you say peace? Because certainly there's a lot of aspects to it. Maybe just shout out.
Harmony.
Maybe I should ask the question. Well, you know, to be a peacemaker, what are the different avenues that we need to take to really talk about peace in our world?
Justice.
Okay.
I was going to say comfort, but then you change what you're doing.
Comfort.
I don't think there's any comfort if you want to try to get peace.
That's true. That's true. Okay.
Where there's pain and dissension, disagreement, and see about making peace there.
Okay.
I don't know what the word is he would use for that.
Yeah.
Well, conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. Conflict management. Is that what you mean?
Well, just looking for it and alleviating the pain.
Alleviating pain. Let's put that.
A-L-L-E-B-I.
Okay.
Well, I would say then conflict management.
Okay.
If you're not going, you all say that.
That it's something active, it's not something that just happens.
Okay.
Something that has to be worked on.
Okay, well, it's certainly broad ranging. I think we'll come back to this later and build on that too. Okay, our ELCA, compared to other denominations, I'd just like to take a moment to see if we can share a little bit how. Our church is a new church. We've just been born or merged together, and it's really in the formative years, and I think we need to really take seriously what is happening in our church and what direction it's going to take and how we're going to be formed in the future and what direction we're going to go in. And I guess it's maybe natural to look around us and see if there's models from other churches and what's being done in other churches and if we want to model some of those things. Are you aware of what other denominations are doing and how much priority they are putting on peace education and peace projects? Is anybody?
I can speak a little bit from the Methodist point of view. A couple of years ago, the bishop in the Pacific Northwest wrote, I can't remember the name of it now, but it was a document on peacemaking that was shared with all the congregations, and there were workshops that were held in different locations where people studied the document and tried to figure out ways of implementing what it said in their own congregations, and they had a really good videotape that went along with it. And it would be it would be a good document, I think, for the ELCA to study.
Yeah.
As an example.
Now, do you think that came from the National Church or more from...
I think that came from the local bishop.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, and the Methodists call it a conference.
Okay, yeah, that's right, okay.
But you have a national bishop statement as well. It's called In Defense of Creation. And the primary drafter was Alan Geyer. And it's something parallel to the Roman Catholic bishop's letter, pastoral letter.
Yeah.
Came out in about 85, I think.
We studied it in our college.
Did you?
Yeah. The Catholic or the Methodist?
The Methodist.
Okay. And those are helpful, aren't they, to have something from the national churches?
Was just out of curiosity, was part of that when it was given out, was the understanding each congregation would study it then? Was that the...
No, we didn't study it until after it became fact.
No, we didn't study it about 9 months later. I think that was the idea that each congregation was supposed to take it and study it. But we did not hear about
it. Well, it was in process.
I was in process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did our church.
We didn't hear about it until there was just one person in our church who happened to hear about it. She went to our minister and said, hey, listen, we need to look at this. And so she led the group.
Well, that sort of brings up one point that I am concerned about. Our Church and Society Commission of the National Church is in the process of forming the first social statement, which will really sort of lay the groundwork and the foundation for further statements of our church. And all these things have to be decided now. All the process needs to be decided. Everything's being born and shaped anew. And so I think the thinking is that we need to have more input from grassroots as we form these social statements so that they really do become more a part of our whole body of the church. And so that's something to give some thought to. And do you, anybody want to say any more about that whole process that's happening? Or?
Well, you're right. That'll be at the assembly in August of this year, the foundation statement. Others in broad areas, including environmental responsibility, world peace, I don't know what all of them are. I think they've got five general areas they're working on, will come over the next decades. I mean,
yeah,
it won't all happen at once. And in the meanwhile, surely you may know, the predecessor body statements continue to apply.
Right.
At least where they are not in conflict.
Yeah.
Now, there are some issues on which predecessor churches did not agree. Capital punishment is one.
Mm-hmm.
The LCA had an anti-death penalty position for 20 years or more. The ALC did not. Mm-hmm. It did not have a position either way on the death penalty. But where they agree, and I think the nuclear arms issue was one where there was quite a bit of agreement, there the predecessor church body positions apply until the new church takes a position of its own.
Yeah. So we can operate on those old ones, and it will take a while to form the new ones. And also, just so you're all aware, there are forms that can be filled out if you yourself or if you know of anybody that would like to be involved in the process, because not only do they need people with expertise in certain areas like arms reduction or whatever, but even just feedback from, you know, a local congregation. How does the average person in the pew view these kind of things? What do they know and don't know? What do they want to know? And so they really are looking for lots of input, and anybody that's, you know, interested at all in that whole process should submit their name to the Commission for Church and Society. So I'd encourage you to do that. Well, I just want to mention that one thing, well, a couple things I'm aware of. Traditionally, the Mennonite and Brethren and Quakers have been what they call peace churches, and that means pretty much, as I understand it, taking a stand against war and supporting conscientious objectors. And to my knowledge, the United Church of Christ has recently voted as a national church to take this stand also, and they have been putting a high priority on peace education and have designated funds for peace projects. And they have a process whereby the local people study these things and come to some kind of a consensus, and it goes sort of from the bottom up. So as I understand it, the bottom has laid this groundwork, and now the top is proclaiming this to be a definite view of their church. And I think the method, or I'm aware of Methodists that put out, the National Church puts out resources, and they have Mr. Rogers as a part of some family kinds of activities for peacemaking that are pretty impressive. The Episcopal Church, I know, designates funds for different projects, and it's very much seems to be involved in peacemaking. So I think our church, as a new church, really has to be thinking about this. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but we have the structure, and I'm no expert on this, but please jump in if you understand this better. But we do have the Commission for Church and Society, and under that commission falls the Department of Peace Education, and we have a director for peace education, Jean Martinson, in the Chicago office, and then she has an assistant, Netsy Griffith, and that's really the department for our entire church. And aren't we the third or fourth largest denomination, and how many million people?
Except that there's a Washington office.
Yeah, right.
A lot of which works on foreign policy questions and peace questions. There's a New York office at the UN.
Oh, yes, that's right.
With Raleigh Deffenbaugh, and some of his work is in that area. In fact, an intern who worked with Raleigh this last year is here on summer staff.
Oh, right now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat.
I don't remember her name. I just met her yesterday. And then there are, I think, 18 or 19 state advocacy offices,
right,
that are under Church and Society.
Right. And I'm going to mention that.
Basically working with advocacy at the state government level.
Right.
So
and I want to come back to that. Right.
Pieces of them.
Right. And that's what's a little confusing about our new church, I think. There are these different avenues that are really definitely working for peace, but in sort of different areas and under different umbrellas. Well, one thing that evidently has come out of the Church Commission for Church and Society, the National Board of the Commission for Church and Society evidently met in March, and there was a resolution sort of because they are aware of the Presbyterian Church designating a Sunday each year for a peace emphasis and taking a peace offering that goes directly into peacemaking activities. Evidently, our church liked that model and wanted to bring that as a possibility for our church. And according to this information I've received, the resolution had to be reworked in order to be acceptable. And the way it was passed, it reads, "Whereas peacemaking is not a program or an issue, but is at the core of what it means to be a follower of Christ, and whereas this church is called to serve in response to God's love, to meet human needs, advocating dignity and justice for all people, working for peace and reconciliation among the nations, and standing with the poor and powerless, and committing itself to their needs, and whereas the Commission for Church and Society is responsible for this church's program to combat world hunger and its program of peace education, be it resolved that the Commission for Church and Society, through its board, networks, synodical offices, and congregational contacts, continue to expand its peacemaking constituency, and that it encourage and support initiatives to fund the witness for peace by, for, and through every expression of the Church, individual, congregational, synodical, regional, national, and international." And it doesn't really designate anything specific. And then later in this information it says that whatever happens relative to establishing an offering will come first from the people in the pew. It will rise and spread from one synod to the next, but the support, however, of both the council members and the bishops will be invaluable to the efforts to invite members to sustain the peace and justice ministries of the ELCA. So I think what they're trying to say is that they really want this kind of emphasis to come from the grassroots and not to be designated from the top down. And that's an interesting concept, and I'm finding that in all areas of peace work that you have to be so careful that you're not dictating peace. It's really nothing that you can dictate. It sort of has to come from the heart. So that's sort of interesting to keep in mind, and we as the people of the church hopefully can go home and really think about these kinds of things and try to raise awareness that we might want to designate a Sunday, and we might want to designate some monies to add to what our church is doing. Another thing I just wanted to share with you is Bishop Chilstrom. I have this letter that evidently went out to all churches when, shortly after he became bishop, and I just think it really speaks a lot of his priority for peacemaking, and sort of interesting how the church operates. This is in the time when the INF treaty was being debated in our country, and he writes, "Dear sisters and brothers in Christ, in recent months I have visited the Middle East, the Soviet Union, Rome, and England. In the future I expect to travel to Central America, Eastern Europe, and Africa," which I think he probably has done by now. I know he has Central America and Africa. "In each place I visited, I was overwhelmed by the gracious hospitality extended to me as your bishop. The formation of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is greeted with keen interest. Our coming together is seen as a hopeful sign in a deeply divided world." And that is a neat model just of the merging together. "Whenever I travel, I hear our brothers and sisters longing for peace in the world. In many ways and with remarkable courage, they also are working for peace. In countries whose governments are hostile to Christianity, they are finding ways to overcome enmity and suspicion. Often at considerable risk, they affirm their ties with us as members of the body of Christ." And I find this in people I know in all around the world, that it's amazing to me what's happening simultaneously by lots of grassroots people and activities, that there's a real commitment everywhere. "In countries like ours, where religious freedom is guaranteed, a very different kind of commitment is needed. Massive disinterest in peace efforts is our greatest challenge. Through vigorous debate and educational programs, we are called to challenge policies which hinder peacemaking and support those which reduce tensions among the and within nations. Grounded in word and sacrament, the Church proclaims God alone as our source of hope for a renewed world. We stand now at a historic moment, the signing of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty." And then he goes on to say that he's providing some material for worship and information to pastors and churches so that they can be more informed on the issue. And then at the end he has what you can do, and I think this is really interesting just because it really does apply to all of us. "Pray for peace, renew your resources for peacemaking, study the Bible, educate for peace, devote Sunday morning sessions, adult forums, youth gatherings, and retreats to peacemaking. Advocate for peace. Contact the Lutheran Office on Governmental Affairs." And that's what Chuck was talking about. And I found out, coming from Ohio, here we are, I think, a fairly populated synod. We have three synods in the state. And we don't have one of these government affairs offices.
Doesn't Ohio have one?
No. So what did you say, 19?
18 or 19, I think.
Yeah.
Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa have them. I think Pennsylvania has one. I know Pennsylvania has one.
Maybe
I'm surprised Ohio doesn't.
I know, I am too. And I think part of it.
There are a lot of ELCA Lutherans.
Yeah, right. So, and part of it is just change, you know, it's a new church and somehow that just didn't get in. And part of it's budget, part of it is coordinating all the three synods together to probably hire one person, and that becomes tricky.
Is there one in your region?
Oh yeah, I think. Now our region would cover Michigan. Isn't there one in Michigan?
I think there is one in Michigan, but there's no regional staff person working on peace issues that I'm aware of in any of the regions.
Well, and in terms of the government affairs people, they're not really tied to regions, or are they? I mean,
they're all based in Washington.
So
that's
it's
federal
a,
issues.
Yeah, interesting question. So as a person from Ohio, I'm already trying to contact our bishop and, you know, asking this question, and it's going to take time, but I think it's the kind of things we have to keep watching out for. And
I would say it's primarily a budget issue.
Pardon me?
I would say it's primarily a budget issue, probably.
Yeah, I think it is.
The person in Washington is funded by all three synods in Washington, plus monies from the National Church, and it has to be a cooperative effort in order to get a person like that. So
Washington State.
Washington State has one of these advocacy people.
Yeah.
And how many synods are a part of your state?
Three.
Three. Okay. Well, that'd be a good model then.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to do, is learn from one another.
Most of the states that have them, because they're states with large Lutheran populations, have more than one synod.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know.
Minnesota has six. Pennsylvania, I think, has seven. And they have to work together.
Yeah. And
for
they probably
state government issues.
Pool more money, too.
And you're right, it's a combination of synod money and churchwide national money.
Yeah. So
in our case, it started with before the merger with the Red River Valley Synod.
Primarily the LCA. Synod, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Coming together, both LCA and the LC.
Oh.
Was the LCMS too?
No.
Not in ours? Okay.
Would you say it's sort of individuals who were concerned about that issue and they got together and said, when we merge, we want to have this continue or have a...
Well, the man in the office has just moved into it. The groundwork was all set up to keep it in motion. There was no break at all.
But in those that now exist, the groundwork was done before the merger.
Right.
And LCA took the lead, and there was a national coordinator in New York who worked with them, Kay Dauhauer, who's now the director of the Washington office of the new church. But I think all of them that now exist were put in place before the merger.
Yeah.
And so Ohio people could petition the Church and Society folks in Chicago for money to help get an Ohio, a Columbus
Now, wouldn't we need, though, I mean, would the natural thing be to also get budget money from the
synod? I think you'd have to.
Oh,
yeah.
You'd have
because
to.
They're all a combination of synod and national money.
Okay, so that's good
part,
to know.
Part of the national funding for that is from World Hunger Funds.
Mark, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Which also comes through Church and Society.
Yeah, right, I'm aware of that. Huh.
There are...
And that's sort of down.
There are people who, the World Hunger Giving is down, but there are, it also, you need to be prepared for the fact that it raises a lot of controversy with people because they don't want some people don't want their World Hunger money going for advocacy. They want it to go to feed the hungry.
Yeah.
And directly.
And they don't understand that advocacy is a process by which that can happen.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
But it takes a person who's real good in educating people in why this kind of thing gets funded in this way.
Yeah.
So it takes people who are sensitive to both sides of the issue.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's the reality of working through these things. And then we as people, individuals, can certainly be writing to our legislature. And I think that really does make an impact. So, and I'm so proud of Holden for doing that weekly. And I think we probably need more groups that meet weekly to do that kind of thing. Witness for Peace, create or join a congregational or ecumenical group, serve on a synodical commission for church and society, or a group that addresses peace and justice concerns. Are you aware of many congregational groups or support groups like that that just meet for peace and justice concerns? Are there many of those around?
Well, we have one in our community, a real active one. It's ecumenical.
Oh, neat.
In fact, it's called the Ecumenical Task Force on Peace and Justice, and we have had a lot of events and a lot of ecumenical prayer services centered around certain memorable occasions like Martin Luther King Day or Hiroshima or other specific things. We've had a lot of people in a multitude of issues come to the community to discuss them, and we've had a number of action projects. We've had Bible studies.
Mm.
It's a really exciting group.
That's it's ecumenical.
Mm-hmm. Now, where is this?
In Bemidji, Minnesota.
Why do you laugh?
Well, most people do. I thought I'd start, but...
It's a neat town.
Yeah. But it's... I didn't used to laugh, but now I guess I have a certain, righteous pride about it, because
yes,
it is... We have, we've just kind of become a center for that in our area.
How did they get started?
People who have done some traveling to Central America basically began. Mm-hmm. But we were at that point real active in refugee work, and so we have a lot of people in our community from other parts of the world who've been involved in war issues, and have been part of war issues. We had the first Namibian and Mozambican refugees in Minnesota were from Bemidji. And that, of course, confronting, impacting all the time. The Vietnamese refugees, the Cambodian refugees, and Ethiopian people who were coming out there. Some from Romania and Poland and Czechoslovakia. So we had a real mix of people who experienced severe injustices. And then folks had gone to Central America and came back telling their stories and began to see the interconnectedness of issues rather than just one issue here, one issue there. And
realize that if we're going to be a peace and justice sort of group that would look at stuff, it would have to be continue to look at the interconnectedness of all these issues and not just separate out one from another. So that's been a real goal for us.
That's really exciting.
We network with a lot of national groups too, so we can.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. And Minnesota has a Peace and Justice Coalition that is growing, a network of a coalition of peace and justice groups around the state with a newsletter and a calendar events always, and trying to keep people connected to other groups and what they're doing.
Yeah, that's really important. Well, that's great.
Do you have a constitution, I guess, and you elect officers, and is there a paid director or anything like that? Or
none of that. We have a loose structure so we can stay organized, but we had a real commitment to not getting hung up in bureaucracy. But
how do you choose leadership?
We invite people to participate in the issues that are a draw for them, and we form a steering committee that changes a major portion every 6 months. So there's some carryover, but there's a rotation of the leadership that actually sets dates, but we structure by the interest of the people there is what really happens. Someone says, we need to talk about styrofoam cups. Okay, they set it up, they find the resource people, we do that. We have the event. So we have areas of interest, and that's why they change pretty frequently too.
It's probably the networking and all working together, and I mean they might have been doing this on their own, but the fact that you have all these people together then just sort of makes it much more effective, doesn't it?
And now that people know about us, we get offers to host speakers.
Oh, like, yeah.
Someone's coming up from Nicaragua, they call one of our contact people and ask if we would like to have them. And they'll just map out a route that goes through Bemidji. So we get a lot of different folks that way. And we host them overnight. We pay $25 or $50 to take a collection. We don't really have a major budget either.
How about mailings? Doesn't that become expensive? Or?
Well, it does, but we put in our newsletter that we need $20 for our post office box and we need $100 in postage, and we have people write out a check and say, well, this is one I can contribute. And it's work. God only knows how.
Yeah.
Well, that's just, we lay out our needs and people respond. That's how it's been working.
That's
spirit guided to me. It's just Kairos moments constantly happening.
And being specific on your needs is an important thing. People like to.
There are people who can't be real active because of physical problems, but they have a heart for it, and they see it as a way they can help.
Yeah, that's true.
And we have prayer. We let people know specific things to pray for.
Oh, that's neat.
It's been an exciting, growing.
Yeah, that's great.
In our congregation, we have renamed our social ministry committee Peace and Justice. Since the constitution changed about 8 years ago, that's what it's named. But it still deals with the whole agenda.
Yeah.
And every year, the group picks one primarily international or national issue to work on and one primarily local or regional. Several years ago, the local or regional was to try to get more understanding of the economic crisis in rural America. And out of that, we evolved a relationship with a rural congregation. We're in Minneapolis, very urban, with a Southwest Minnesota rural church, and that continues. It's 3 years old now, that relationship.
Ah.
And it's been very rich. It's been a way of our putting faces
with
economic issues.
Tangible.
And we made it so that we would also deal with urban economic issues for their education, the rural people. And people talked about losing jobs because of the Northwest Airlines merger with Republic and that kind of thing. And, we do everything from the Bread for the World offering of letters every year. We stimulate letters on that to the center of work with rural issues. And then we have another group that's been working on refugee resettlement, and they moved from simply resettling refugees, which was relatively non-political.
Ethiopian.
They were all Ethiopians, to now involvement with the Overground Railroad, which is much closer to the politics of U.S. foreign policy because it takes people from, at least we have, Central America, El Salvador, who are en route to Canada. And we host them for, typically it'll be 6 months, while they learn some English and get ready to move on to the north where they're legally admitted. And that's working directly with the U.S. government, because they are legal in this country as long as they're en route to Canada. But it raises all the issues of the politics of why are they en route from El Salvador to Canada?
Yeah.
And why doesn't our country accept them and recognize them as political refugees and so on? We are doing that with two other churches, one Lutheran and one Roman Catholic, so that are neighbor churches. So it gives us some ecumenical involvement.
Oh, that's neat.
You should mention the next step.
Well, we talked a little bit about that last night here in a forum, but I'll just mention our two churches that are rural and our urban congregations are planning together to become sister parish to a Costa Rican congregation.
Yeah.
Through a program which Vicki is stateside coordinator for.
Oh my.
Called Sister Parish.
Oh,
and as a group, we'll look at rural urban issues and the connectedness globally.
There's some things emerging that I've certainly found in my peacemaking. This tangible thing of, you know, connecting a congregation to a congregation. Also, these issues are really sort of abstract, but if you start putting faces with the issue, that really means a lot. And then the fact that you laid some groundwork, started with a little less controversial issue of just resettling people, then it sort of builds into a little more commitment and wrestling with the issues. And I think that's definitely needs to be a pattern. Start with something a little less controversial, but grow with it. And this linkage of other countries, any kind of exchange program, or I think those are real effective ways of consciousness and growing in our understanding of peace and justice issues.
No, we don't all do just heavy duty stuff.
Mm.
Last year, the two congregations came out here as a group. People from both congregations came out here as one group.
Oh my.
To Holden. Yeah.
To Holden, and we enjoyed each other for a week. Plus,
that's an interesting
holding
twist. That's very good. Well, then I just want to make sure everybody is aware of one of the other things that says, what can we do? Join Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And here, who am I to be talking about Lutheran Church Peace Fellowship? We have the head director is Tom Witt, and she's his secretary, or the other person in the office, is Anne
Hafton,
and she's here in the village. And then part of their newsletter that just came out, Peace Notes, Jan Bowman, she wrote something in here. Maybe she wrote in Peace Petitions, I know. But Jan was on the trip that they sort of talk about the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and Jan went on the trip that sort of spearheaded a lot of these things. And the letter writing that was done last night, wasn't it, is sort of based on this whole idea of there's this message of concern and talks about the things that people can do, and part of that letter writing hooks into this. So the village is just full of these people that are so involved, and it's really neat. But anyway, if you're not familiar with the Peace Fellowship, I think this sort of describes it. This was given to me by the Puget Sound Area Group, that's sort of a local chapter of the national group. And it says, it describes the national as having begun nationally during the World War II for conscientious objectors, and during the Vietnam War, interest in draft status and peace concerns in the Lutheran Church brought the effort to life again. It continues nationally with an office in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then they sort of sponsor the local groups. And this is, again,
I think it's a little misleading in our church since we do have this one division for peace education, and this is really separate, but it's so much a part of peacemaking. And I was thinking about this, I think it's a very healthy way to operate, because the people that join this, I mean, this is available to anybody that wants to join, and you can send in your contribution and be on their news mailing list and get their newsletter. And they are here to certainly support people for conscious objection, and then they get into tax resistance and really quite a few different areas. They've also made up resource lists for just general reading and peacemaking with children and different resources. And so they're really there to support people that are pretty serious about peace and justice issues. And I think as a church, considering everybody in the church, not everybody's at the same level. And this is definitely a serious group. So if you're at that level, then this is somewhere that you can hook into. And I think it's probably healthy that, you know, they're not dictating things for the entire church. Like tax resistance, I think, is one area where not everybody feels the same way about it. But some people feel very strongly. So here you have a outlet where you can join hands with other people and feel that support. So if you don't have this in your area, and I see here again in Ohio, I don't think there's anything like this. And it might be interesting to pursue the idea of getting a local chapter. And evidently the national office has some money to start these chapters, and I think it's a typical pattern that they pay a person for one day's work a week to keep the organization going and do the planning. And then I guess I won't take time to read the peace statement, but it's sort of interesting to read what they're all about. So that, and like, here's another piece that they put out, organizations working for peace, and this is sort of a national groups that are certainly working hand in hand on the same kinds of issues, and they put out this kind of information. So it's really very helpful. Another thing is peace petitions, and this is a news for ELCA peacemakers, and now this is open for anybody that's interested in peace issues, and this is really very helpful because it really lets you know what's happening in the areas of peace and justice, and they really try to concentrate on South American issues and East-West issues and Namibian South African issues. And so anything that comes up in those areas, they try to inform people. And here again, Jan Bowman, that's here in the village, wrote this last article on children of the Ifita, and sort of on her experience being in Israel and Palestine this January, past January. And then I also would like to point out our national church, if we ask what are they doing, well, they've put out a resource guide for children, parents, and teachers called the ABCs of Peacemaking. And right here is where you write for it. It's only $3. It's from the ELCA Distribution Center. And that's just recently been put together. And I know it's, I haven't seen it, but I know the input of it was just excellent and will be a wonderful resource. So at least those kinds of things are happening. And then even in this petitions that comes out 4 times a year, they have resources in the back included. Now, one thing I'm a little concerned about is that I was told that this, they had money for 3 issues and maybe 4 a year. And here's a case where I'm sure they would love to be putting this out more, or certainly getting wider coverage too. And I know that they're trying to get committees, like if you have a social action committee in your local church, see if you can't get the whole committee to subscribe. They have sort of like group rates, and maybe your church council, you could get the whole church council to subscribe to this. And it's doubled its readership, I'm sure, just in the last year. It really is taking off since we've begun as a new church, but there's certainly a lot more that could be done with this, and hope that it grows a lot. Then there's other things that I'm not even sure how this all fits together, but I see through the peace petitions that they mention different areas like this National Namibia Concerns, and that's evidently sort of a separate group in Denver, Colorado. Can you share a little more about that?
It's an independent group that grew up originally around Wartburg Seminary when there was a Namibian theological student there 10 to 15 years ago, and then moved its office to Denver, but works closely with the, I don't think they limit it to ELCA, I think they're trying to work with the Church of Missouri Synod as well, but as Lutheran Peace Fellowship does, by the way.
Peace
Fellowship is pan-Lutheran.
Yeah.
Independent.
And non-Lutheran, they'll accept.
Well, they'll accept non-Lutheran members too, sure. But they try to work with people in all of the Lutheran constituencies.
Yeah.
And National Namibia Concerns does that as well.
And then I read about a South American group, I think, that...
Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, maybe?
That's one.
Vicky's on its board, aren't you?
Or you're the liaison to... the National Board for Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, and that is...
Is that the one?
I think it was in here. It was a reference to somebody, or somebody wrote an article, or... Tell us about yours, I'll see.
Tell me who it is, I'll tell you.
Okay.
There's another. Are you going to talk about Justice Network in the Lutheran Church?
I don't think I know about that.
Okay, there's up on the bulletin board in the dining hall, there's a piece on the Justice Network in the Lutheran Church. It started out as Justice and the New Lutheran Church. It was pre-merger grassroots organizations that were trying to keep the merger always aware of justice issues and keep justice issues as a high priority as they formulated the church. When they, for instance, probably could be called responsible for the quota system, really pushing the idea of minority group, people of color, different minority level groups uppermost, you know, in the quota system of the merged church. But since the merger now have used the same acronym and are called Justice Network in the Lutheran Church, JNLC. And it's a broad coalition of grassroots organizations, including the Namibia Concerns, Lutheran Peace Fellowship, Sister Parish that I'm with, Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, all of these groups.
Lutheran Human Relations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Elders for Justice.
All of these are independent groups.
Independent groups, but keep the issues of justice before the church. And, for instance, we are renting a room at the Churchwide Assembly in August, and we'll have a very strong presence there again as justice organizations in the church. We published a newsletter, there's a membership. We have a day of dialogue with ELCA officials every January. We have division heads and division folks that come together with the grassroots people and we hear each other out. And what's it like to be a bureaucrat and try to do justice? What it's like to be a grassroots organizer and try to do justice? So it's a very strong movement in the Lutheran Church, and there are newsletters hanging on the bulletin board on the summer offerings. Mm-hmm. Part of the summer offerings, I think, are going to the Justice Network.
It was hanging on the...
Oh, okay.
Where the glad
you mentioned that. Yes.
I think one of three recipients.
Yeah.
JNLC.
It's a great group to get connected with. There's some real vital people in that group.
There's a caucus for gay and lesbian concerns within the
Lutheran's JNLC. Wingspan, yeah. I think they're all part of it. Any issue you want, they've published a directory with all their names and addresses and where you get resource stuff. The directory costs like $5 or $2 or something like that.
What's the elders group called? Paul and Carola Bow have been active leaders.
I thought it was Elders for Justice. They're
elders
meeting here
at
Holden in September. But it's people who are older, retired, who are looking at issues of aging, but other justice issues too, as I understand.
Now, what was I going to ask you? Do they have a newsletter?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Here's the name of, that's what you're a part of.
Yeah, Susan Berkelow is the coordinator of Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, LUCOLA. And there's an address how to get their newsletter. And I haven't been to my first board meeting yet, but I know that it's a coalition of folks specifically dealing on that with Latin American issues. And have a network of hotline kind of thing, telephone tree kind of thing. For instance, when the offices in Lutheran Church of the Resurrection were bombed, we all got phone calls about that, and groups organized to go down, be accompaniment groups to the folks in El Salvador, that kind of emergency response kinds of things to any of the issues in Latin America.
Oh, that's interesting. I see, I mean, it's, I always find out new things, and I'm just not that familiar with it. And then you mentioned human relations, what's it?
Lutheran Human Relations.
And I even forgot about that.
Which has traditionally dealt with issues of racial justice.
They brought people
with gender justice and, yeah, I think they still specialize in concerns between the white majority and ethnic minorities. That's their primary role. But they've also done a lot with gender justice. Mm-hmm. In recent years, mm-hmm. and other issues of justice. They have a new, they have a newspaper, Vanguard,
yeah,
a monthly,
right.
I think it's a monthly paper.
It's really a good...
And do workshops in the summer, or do
they have a summer, annual summer national institute in Milwaukee, is where their office is.
And so...
All these are independent groups.
Yeah, and I think it's a little confusing to people, but...
And that's why the Justice Network is really important.
Yeah.
If you want to get the directory, it's just JNLC and care of Lutheran School of Theology, their offices. LSTC, Lutheran School of Theology, 1100 East 55th Street in Chicago. And they provide a directory, which is very helpful. And it helps bring the issues together for me. You know, good broad overview. Then people can kind of deal with it.
Yeah, and that's helpful. So, well, I think amazing how all these things that are going on. So, in one sense, it seems like maybe at the national level there's this one person, but in reality, there's really a lot of things going on. I think it's important though to know all these things that are going on. I certainly don't know them all. One reason I'm doing this is I attended as a representative of the Southern Ohio Synod. Church and Society Committee. I attended a national consultation for peace education in Chicago in February. And at that consultation, we had 36 synods represented. And it was sort of an attempt to get the synod representatives for peace education together, and the national could sort of explain what's going on from their vantage point and sort of glean what's going on from the synodical level. And again, this is such a formative time in our church life, and so the more we can be aware of what's going on, the better. So I just want to briefly mention some things, and then please jump in if you can add to this. What they did is they broke down our sessions into three different categories: peacemaking in the home, in the congregation, and in society. And peacemaking in the home, just for those of you that are interested in that area, Kathy McGinnis and her husband Jim are co-directors of the Institute for Peace and Justice in St. Louis, Missouri, and this is a wonderful organization that promotes parenting for peace and justice. Their book is in the bookstore, Parenting for Peace and Justice. They give workshops, have written lots of material, some curriculum kinds of things. She's co-authored a book, this Kathy has co-authored with a woman from Ohio, Barbara Olberg, called Starting Out Right. The subtitle is Nurturing Children to be Peacemakers. And those of you that are interested in sort of the preschool, early elementary age, wonderful book on just the whole philosophy of peacemaking and tangible ideas on what to do with children, how to be a conscious parent and be intentional about raising your children with multicultural ideas and interracial pictures and all kinds of things.
What were those names again, the authors?
Okay, Kathy McGinnis, McGinnis. And the book is Starting Out Right. That's the major title. And the other author is Olberg. I think it's O-L-O-E-L-B-U-R-G or something like that.
But McGinnis, I think you'll find it under her name. She's written so many books, McGinnis. Okay, in the congregation, they presented a session called Nurturing Creative Conflict in the Church, and they brought in Lynn Fitzhugh, who's the director of Peace Between People, based in Seattle, Washington. She did a lot of things on nonviolent skills for transforming conflict. And this is sort of the idea, and I wish I would have attended last night's session on, I think you must have touched a little bit on, how do you introduce controversial issues within the church and how do you work through that conflict?
We even heard testimony from pastor about how not to do it.
Yeah.
Because he had gotten burned.
And that's really tricky. And it, I mean, it's so sad to think that here our congregations are, somebody said it's the last place that you'd want to do peacemaking, I mean, because of all the
it's
controversy.
It's a fighting word in congregations. Yes. I thought of that when you were asking us to free associate. Sometimes peace is a conflict idea.
Yeah, and people want to keep a sort of harmony in the congregation, and so they really avoid these very important issues. Now, I attended, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Albion Institute in Washington, D.C., and they did a marvelous workshop on this very thing, how do you overcome conflict? And their approach was, and I think this is a really exciting thing that can be used in any setting, try to glean people's stories, their personal stories. Pick a topic, and I think we did the sort of anti-Russian idea and nuclear war idea, and they said, well, what has been your experience with the Soviet Union, or what's been your experience with nuclear war? And people started thinking, and I started thinking, you know, well, I don't even know how I came to my ideas on this, but you start thinking back, what things played a part in your life to build your thoughts on this subject? And pretty soon, if you start sharing your personal stories, you're going to find out that the older people are going to have certain things that shape their experience, younger people are going to have certain things that stood out in their lives, and then you begin to understand, oh, I sort of understand why he feels that way or she feels that way, because they had that experience in their life. And then pretty soon, if you can sort of lift up these things and share these things and then try to pull out the commonality, what do you share, what can you agree on, what can bring you together and build on that, then that's a good way to start. So I think that's one approach in our churches that we need to use.
To share real quick personally that happened just along that line. We've had a lot of struggling in our church with peace and justice issues. And the more I think about language and the use of the words, the more I'm learning about how that affects people. And there's a group of older folks in our church that have just gotten so riled up. And I couldn't understand why. How could they? Peace, justice, good words. And one guy finally just exploded at one of our mission committee meetings. He says, I can't stand to hear the word justice one more time. He said, my urge was to say, I wanted to hear what he wanted to say about that. So we talked, and he said, he lived through World War II. He served in Europe, and he said, what Hitler wanted was justice, and ever since that time, when I hear that word, my hair just curls, and I get angry, and I get mad, and I just can't stand anybody using that word. And so we had a chance to talk about the different perspectives of what that word means to different people, and it was a breakthrough. It was a real breakthrough. He felt heard, and he'd never said it before, but he felt heard, and he's much more open now to some of the things we talk about, because we've come to some understanding with each other. It's been a really neat thing to happen, but it helped me understand why he got so mad every time we prayed for justice.
That's really important.
Yeah, it just really taught me a major lesson.
That's why when you started out and you said, what does peace mean to you, was your original question up there. And I thought of comfort right away, a real comforting to me.
Yeah.
And then you changed your question to how do we work for peace? And my whole definition totally flip-flopped.
Oh, that's
and
amazing.
I thought, that isn't what it means to me. It's something very difficult to work for. It takes a lot of time, work, and effort.
Yeah. Just the total opposites, yeah. Just by your changing that definition.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'll tell Sherry, I guess what I was sort of driving at is all the areas of PC. I thought we would start talking about homeless and hungry and different injustices in the world. And it's just really interesting. I mean, it's just such a complex word and brings to mind so many different images. And I was sort of driving at the complexity, but it came out a little different way. But that's okay. Also, this woman did a lot of listening exercises, and I think that's just so much a part of peacemaking and working for justice is listening, and it's not easy. And she does exercises like, you know, people talk and then they try to explain what the other person said. And you know, you might hear something a different way than what they meant. And so we really have to be so careful. That's why your example is just really, really interesting on how people have these images. And you didn't know that he felt that way about the word.
He lived through what he lived through.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we need to know that and share those stories.
It's the same thing that's happening with that flag burning issue right
now.
Oh,
yeah.
Is that there are people who, for whom the flag represents something that they fought in a war for.
That's right.
And then there are others on the other side of the issue who say it's just, you know, just a symbol that doesn't really mean all that much. It's a piece of cloth.
Yeah.
You know, and so yeah. It just shows how those feelings run deep.
Yeah.
With people on those kinds of issues.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I've been hearing a lot about that.
Yeah, that's right.
Same note. My first recollection of the atomic bomb, mm-hmm. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was when I was 14, mm-hmm. and my dad was in Europe as a military chaplain, and that was good news because that was going to end the war and Daddy would come home.
Ah.
And I'm not there today, but I remember where we were in 1945. Those of us who were old enough to be thinking about that, and the original word about that kind of weaponry was a positive word for us in this country. And a lot of people are still there, and they still see nuclear weaponry as keeping the peace.
Oh,
and, you know, they don't laugh about the fact that the Strategic Air Command says our business is peacemaking. Because, you know, I'm now very anti-nuclear weaponry for security. I think that's foolish. But at one time, I was very positive about that.
Isn't it?
And my first awareness of the word peace, in fact, was the end of World War II. We were now at peace.
Yeah.
And that meant, in our family, Dad's coming home. And he'll come home sooner than if the peace hadn't been reached.
Well, I think I really am coming to more appreciation of the age span and what you live through and how that shapes your life.
Yeah.
And we need to...
The generation shaped by Vietnam is very different.
That's
from
right.
The generation shaped by World War II, and I feel like I'm kind of in between the two.
Yeah.
Or the generation post-Vietnam.
That's right.
That's right.
It's a completely different group.
Yeah.
You can maybe comment on the college perspective and how.
Well, it's just, I mean, a lot of us assume that these college students,
they remember Vietnam.
Yeah.
They don't remember that.
They don't.
Yeah, they weren't born. John Kennedy.
Yeah. And they've never had to face the draft. They don't know anything
about
the issues of conscientious objection and use of force or non-use of force. They've never had to deal with that.
Yeah.
It's distressing that they don't know about that stuff.
Yeah.
So, it's quite
different. Appreciate that. Let's see. Okay, and I just might mention, I don't know if you've ever heard of Alternatives to Violence. I think there's a couple different programs in the nation, and somebody told me that they were, the people that started them were friends or something, and then they sort of went different paths, which sort of, I think, shows you how I think we just need to do peacemaking, where we are, how we can do it best, and it all works out in the end. The course Alternatives to Violence that I'm familiar with is a session of about 10, or it can even be expanded to 20 sessions, and it takes this idea of violence and talks about the
nature of violence and the characteristics of violence, and then goes into how you can deal with things in a nonviolent way, and gets into what causes violence, and gets into simple lifestyles and more justice issues. And the idea of the course is to come out with a much better understanding of violence and justice, and really trying to get people to change their minds, to get them more aware of what's really going on. And it's really sort of this Holden philosophy, you know, why are we eating the way we are? Well, there's a reason. And so that's one person's attempt. Now in Ohio, there's one man that's developed this curriculum, and he goes around and does workshops, and he's getting it into the schools, and trying into communities, into police forces, into all kinds of areas. I mean, there's so much implication of changing people's minds in different areas. And I think in the church, that it's that whole idea of how do you change people's minds and how do you bring them to greater awareness. So it might be valuable to just be aware that there are courses designed like that. Then the last category was peacemaking in society, and they presented this Robert Krinsky from the National Committee for Economic Conversion and Disarmament presented a presentation on a process of converting military dependent communities into communities where production is geared to civilian markets. And he pointed out that 26 million Americans are now dependent on a military economy. So if we talk about reduction of arms, we're talking about putting people out of jobs, and that there's a justice component to that. So what do we do? Well, I can't begin to explain all the theories along these lines, but to me, the simple idea of possibly taking people that are obviously in economically or technological jobs, and putting that technology to something like solar energy or more responsible use of the environment seems to make a lot of sense, and seems fairly simple, although I'm sure it's not real simple, but we need to be thinking along those terms very definitely, I think. And I think, just want to share with you what the Rocky Mountain Synod did. I think this is really exciting. They organized this weekend called Peacemaking, Arms, and a Test of Faith. They had this in February. I've been hoping to hear something about it. Is anybody from Colorado or knows about this? They had, they asked, the brochure says, if you are employed, are you employed by, and they list all these different White Sands, Air Army bases, Rocky Flats, all these different places. It's time for the church to listen to your concerns. Come to this grassroots planned event for all who are employed in science or technological aspects of the military in the Rocky Mountain Synod. Come to dialogue and to listen to one another and discover ways the church can affirm your vocation. And they claim that these people that are in these jobs have sort of a tug of war within themselves. They're in church Sunday morning and they go to their job Monday morning, and they're just not sure how it all fits together, and who do they talk to. So this was an attempt to get these people together and really talk about what their concerns are. Now, I'm the kind of person, I admit my prejudice, you say military installation and all of a sudden I'm just sort of anti, and it's terrible. I mean, I've got to overcome my prejudice and learn to listen to these people and understand where they're coming from. And so this is sort of combining this idea of listening and dialoguing and this idea of what does a synod do, how can they be helpful, and then it'll be interesting to know what comes out of this. But I think this is certainly a place to start.